Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Taurus Report. I am here with my friend Lee Greer, once again, looking at things that we've seen in the news lately that challenge standard cosmology. And again, this week, we're going to delve into some large-scale structure, just basically big objects we're seeing in the universe where standard cosmology has a difficult time explaining how those could form in 13 billion years, which is what standard cosmology says is the age of the universe. So I would like to share a screen here.
Absolutely. And good evening, Joe. This is, yes, a nice spring evening, huh?
Yes. Good evening, and thank you, Lee, for joining us once again.
Absolutely.
And, I am sharing here the site that you had mentioned to me, which is an article at physics.org about the another large-scale structure that this same team has discovered. They discovered one earlier. And this one now that they've discovered is depicted here in this picture as a ring. And what had been discovered previously was that red arc. And so, Lee, I was hoping that you might touch on briefly for a layperson, if you can explain why. I mean, standard cosmology is saying the universe is 13.8 billion years. And if it is such, why should we not see structures this large? You know, as far as trying to explain to a layman, like, why is that? Why is something this large, a structure like this, why should we not see something like that in the night sky?
Right. Well, two of the... Maybe I'll quickly screen share as well.
Yes, I'm stopping my screen.
Two of the major assumptions that are important in regular in cosmology and have been guiding lights in cosmology for a while. One, they're summarized as the cosmological principle, right? That at representatively large scales, the universe must have a distribution that is essentially homogeneous, whichever, you know, as you go out through space, and also isotropic, in that whichever direction you look, there is no preferred direction, and it's going to have the...
It's going to look similar.
It's going to look similar pretty much wherever it is. And it's kind of an extension of the Copernican principle that we're not viewing from a special location, but from a fairly typical location within our universe. And the Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker cosmologies, which are essentially the framework of the Big Bang cosmology, basically holds that in an expanding universe, you're going to see this homogeneous and isotropic universe going out. And given the various assumptions that are in the lambda cold dark matter version of that theory, and the constraints in time by taking the reciprocal of the measured Hubble constant, we only have about 13.8 billion years to deal with. And using what are called n-body simulations, they propose that the largest structure should be about 1.2 billion light years across. That would be expected to form within our universe. And so stuff that is larger than 1.2 billion light years starts to become a problem for the simulations and for the basic assumptions with
Right. And so, and I think
cosmology. Correct.
it's part of the problem, if I understand it correctly, is that they're starting from assuming that the CMB is the afterglow of the Big Bang.
Correct.
You've got to kind of assume that. And I think I'd like to share a screen for a second,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
if I may interrupt you there. So
No, you're fine.
we will share back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the thing that I wanted to just point out in regards to what you're saying
Yes.
is that if you look at, so here's a picture of the CMB, and for a layperson, what this is if you look in the night sky in any direction, we get this sort of background radiation coming at us from all directions in space. And standard cosmology assumes that this is a snapshot, basically, of the Big Bang. And
Yes.
so, because it is more or less, I mean, obviously, we see looking at it that it's not like perfectly uniform, but
No.
seems to be roughly speaking, you know, there's no particular special place. There is no, you know, big structure. I mean, there are some big spots of colder areas and warmer areas and so on and so forth. But it all sort of looks kind of random going in all directions. And so if this is a snapshot of the early universe, and then if we look out in today's universe and we see something like this, basically the problem comes in where we have to have a model that can explain how we get from this, which is a very little structure, how do we get from this to this, where we have some big structure. Now, since we're in the standard cosmology, it is based upon the Hubble constant, where space itself is stretching over time.
Yeah.
Then, if we see some big structure now, then that means if we stare back in time, we should see that same exact structure somewhere smaller. You know, sort of like if you imagine drawing a little tiny picture on the surface of a balloon and you blow that balloon up, then that picture that you drew would be larger. Okay. And so, depending on how large the size is, and if you know the expansion rate of that balloon, then you can say how large that structure was at the beginning. And you can explain through your model how it developed over time. Now, the problem that they're having with these structures is that we're seeing structures that are so large, they could not have expanded to that size in 13 billion years. And so that's basically what the problem we're seeing, because 13 billion years ago, everything, you know, in essence, there was no structure. That's the problem.
Well, right. Yes, that's right. The universe is young. Of course, they also have to herald, in order to make these assumptions work, they have to herald dark matter and all of that to help assemble the large structures in filamentary ways and all of that. So hence there are the use of these simulations, which where they take certain set of differential equations that are part of the basic model, and plug in these values, and then try to get something that approximates what we see in the
Right.
object.
So you can play with dark matter and dark energy. You can play with it, play with those as parameters, play with those as variables in
Yes.
order to try to get the structure that we're seeing now. Now, the difficulty, of course, as we've expressed many times in this show about that, is all of physics is based on pushes and pulls.
Yes.
Essence. That's
Yes.
what does exist.
That's right. Yep.
Now, if you allow a theorist to put an undetectable dark matter anywhere he likes in his model, basically all you would be doing is you'd be putting in a pull wherever you need a pull, and you can't explain it. And then if you're allowed to put dark energy in sufficient quantities wherever you see it, wherever you need it for your model to work, then you're allowing yourself to put an invisible push wherever your model needs it. And yep. Since all of physics is pushes and pulls, you know, basically you can make with the sufficiently right quantities of dark matter and dark energy, in my opinion, you could make any model work if you're allowed to do that. And notice that it's the same with dark energy. I've had it expressed to me that, well, dark energy is put in as a constant. And in fact, with the recent things we've been seeing with the Hubble tension, is the model doesn't work with it as a constant. And so now they're talking about a dynamic constant, which is sort of a contradiction in terms, I think, to have a dynamic constant, you know, to change it to wherever you need, depending on the context. And all of that in addition to inflation, which is a whole different phase of expansion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, with dark energy, it is put in disks, or I'm sorry, dark matter, that is put in disks and filaments wherever needed, you know. And since it does not interact electromagnetically, one wonders, how did the dark matter explode or get distributed to where it needed to be to make these filaments and stuff if it doesn't interact with anything? And I once talked to a standard, supporter of GRLCDM about that. And
yes.
His answer was, and maybe he was being a little flippant, but he just says, well, it was just there like that always. and so the matter, as it went out, it was just automatically sort of attracted into this filamentary structure because that's where the dark matter is, you know. And you ask, how did dark matter get into a filamentary structure like that? It's like, well, it was just always like that. And so anyways, I've sort of a long digression, Lee.
Well, part of the problem is that we're approaching 20 years now with structures that are getting bigger, well, more than that are getting that are on the border of or getting larger than our expected cutoff, you know. And that, you know, even the back published in 2005, the Great Sloan Wall of galaxies, you know, which is about 1.38 billion light years across, that, you know, that's a little bit beyond what should be appearing there under current assumptions. But the model keeps being adjusted to try to accommodate these larger and larger structures. What is interesting about this structure, just to return to this structure here, and it's the same team that, here, let me, I'll screen share just a
moment. Yes, it's your turn.
Just a second here. So if, by the way, here is the Great Sloan Wall there, you know, fairly large structure there for sure. Okay, and here it is in 3D.
Now, what's the largest structure that can exist according to the current model, and how large is the Sloan Wall?
The Sloan Wall is 1.38 giga of light years or billion light years, and the largest is supposed to be right around, you know, 1.2 giga light years, although some people have put it back at about 1 billion light years, you know. So there are some fairly large structures which are out there as we go out. I have tried to, within the website here, take, because these are also put in megaparsecs and convert them into giga light years, right? So for instance, here is the South Pole Wall, which is a very large structure, which may be part of a larger structure, which is 500 to 550 megaparsecs, which is about 1.6 to about 1.8.
Well, that's even bigger.
Gigalight years.
Yes, and I just wanted to note
for the audience
that Lee has put together all of this documentation and illustrations at his site, Enlightenment Legacy. And I am going to provide links to this in the comments, along with links to all of the sites to which we refer to in today's episode. So yes, you will be able to see all this documentation and work that Lee has done on this updated. So
yes, and I've recently put some new stuff up there as well, you know. So yes, here are some of the structures just in our area. There's this big Lanikea structure, the Great Attractor, the South Pole Wall, a cold spot repeller, you know, the Perseus Pisces supercluster, so forth. You know, you've got a bunch of structures out there. Here is the giant arc itself, which is about 3.3 gigalight years or billion light years across, and it's about 9.2 gigalight years distance. So that is, you know, with the using the Hubble relation and the standard candles going out there, and which means that this giant arc stretches about over 1/15 of the observable part of the universe, which is, you know, there's a very low probability of that being artifactual, you know.
Right. And that, if I may, are you
absolutely
finished? Yep. Yeah. Okay. So we'll come back.
Yeah, sure. You want me to drop sharing just for
if you could just for a second, because I want to point out something in reference to what you said as far as a small probability of it being an artifact.
Right.
I'd like
right.
to share this article here, which is done by Ethan Siegel and his blog is Starts With a Bang. And he is, I would say, kind of probably the most popular worldwide defender of standard GR LCDM cosmology. And this article I found interesting because in this article, Ethan tries to make the point, and he's very careful how he phrases things. So he's not going to say that these structures just are artifacts, but he's saying that scientists should treat them as if they are artifacts until we do further research. And so I just wanted to, and I will include this link also. And so he goes at great lengths, basically saying, and I guess I will just summarize his view with one anecdote he uses, where he says, like this, what is the structure exactly? It is a finding of a pattern in stars that are absorbing light, like magnesium 2, I think.
Yes, that's correct. Magnesium 2 is one of the, is part of the spectral signatures by which they detected the structure. Yes.
Right. And so Ethan, his analogy is, he's saying like, well, that's like if you were to search for in the United States, as far as housing, giant pink mansions, you know, on 10 acres. Okay, and you search for those, and then you see some kind of pattern in the United States for these giant pink mansions like this. You see some kind of pattern in their distribution, and then it would be wrong to infer that housing in the U.S. follows this pattern. And so that's the analogy that he uses. So what he's basically saying is that this magnesium 2 signature that they're finding in this ring structure that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it? Oh, I have it on a different
down further. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So
There,
yeah,
it is.
the ring structure, he's saying those blue dots are basically the signature of magnesium 2. But he's saying what really needs to be done is a full sky survey of all light, okay, or something. And he says that, you know, because we can't really do that yet, this may be an artifact and not really be indicative of a structure at all. And I have several problems with that. And I am just wondering, Lee, if you have a response to that, or should I just go into it?
Well, I would just quickly say that
stop sharing
with Ethan, that I would love to have a survey of all of those, a full sky survey, and they publicly release all of the redshift data, all the spectra, the infrared, near infrared, visible, and they can throw in the radio and the X-ray spectra too. I'd love to have all of that, and of course I'm sure many astronomers would, because then we'd learn much more about the universe. Obviously there is a limitation instrument wise and all of that,
and just crunching all the data.
Yeah, crunching all the data. But certainly, I think that they've made a pretty good case that there is a structure there. I mean, they come down to a 0.000, that's 3.0003% probability of it simply being an artifact, you know. Now, what is interesting, I'll just show this one thing, and then I would like you to critique Siegel further there, if you wish, is that and this is Lopez et al. 2022. It was published in the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Here's some of their figures, and there's the magnesium absorption and so forth. And here's what it looks like on our sky between near the Boötes, the herdsman. Okay, well, this new structure, this ring, is actually more of a corkscrew. So we're looking at more end on as a corkscrew. The interesting part about this, and it's about 1.3 gigalight years across in diameter and a circumference of about 4 gigalight years, but it's at the same distance. Suppose that it is connected in some way with a larger structure, and the authors raised this question in their paper by the following up on that, because it is approximately the same distance. So
that's interesting.
I think it's even less likely that it's artifactual now. But hey, I would say, Ethan, make your best case for it being artifactual. You know, go right ahead, you know.
Right. And let's see, where do I begin with that? So so I would say that where a lot of this is going to me is in this leaving the realm of science for a minute and going to politics and economics. The argument really to me is about funding. And I've been trying to make the case in my show that it seems to me a lot of computer time and a lot of observational time and just a lot of theorizing and effort in general is going into shoring up LCDM with basically exotic suppositions. You know, when you're factoring in stuff like inflation and dark matter and dark energy, and then, you know, trying to change the Hubble constant in various ways, when you're trying to do all of that and make models that work function based on those assumptions, I have to believe that that is sucking away funding from where it needs to go, which in my view, would be resources should be dedicated towards modified gravity theory, to really encourage people to say that, look, you know, this stuff isn't really working out, because I think it's fairly obvious that it really isn't working. And there's aspects that I always emphasize of general relativity that work extremely well.
Yes.
And the specifically ones that impress me with how well general relativity work. Number one is relativistic increase of momentum when objects are traveling at high velocities, relative high velocities. Their effective mass increase, saying their mass increases isn't strictly accurate, but their momentum increases as if they weighed more.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
So that's why right. I'm saying it. Okay. And time dilation and deflection of light around large masses. Now, all three of those things to me are where general relativity works very well as far as predictions and stuff, and places where it doesn't work so well are very minor, like, let's say, Oumuamua, or in my opinion, comets, or the flyby anomaly. You know, those are pretty minor incidents. And so I can see where a theorist would be, we don't have anything better, so we'll just go with this for now.
Right.
But the big question in cosmology to me is that, to me, funding should go where people are asking the very important question of, why does GR explain these three things extremely well, and it does not work for cosmology? Okay. And that's the million-dollar question that needs to be asked. And the first step in going down that road is for everybody to admit GR doesn't work for cosmology, to suppose things like inflation is absurd.
Yeah.
That is not scientific. That's mathematics. It's not science, in my opinion. So anyways, that's where I feel my, and so this is like a long digression in answering Ethan, but he seems to want to just stay with we work with GR in constructing our cosmology, and that is the default. And, like, anything else gets discounted, and that's what I think he's doing. And I think instead that we should discount GR as far as cosmology goes, based on the evidence we have right now, and start considering looking at cosmology from the perspective of it being wrong and trying to get clues that would explain how gravity really works, wherein we can keep the successes of general relativity, where it does extremely well.
Yes, just like we keep the successes of Newtonian as a heuristic way to solve all kinds of problems, including sending spacecraft different places and all of that, you know.
That's right. That's right. And so I'm done preaching now.
Well, I would just like to add on to that. As far as places for funding to go, I would say, hey, throw out all those, put all the cosmological models that, because there are some rivals now that are challenging the hot Big Bang cosmology in certain aspects and all of that. Just say, look, let's spend money on those places where we see anomalies. And there is a certain amount of that happening. But then let's throw it open and say, look, we've got better instrumentation now than ever before. Let's look at some of the anomalies that have lingered there from years before, as well as some of the new anomalies that have come on since since July of 2022, when the James Webb Space Telescope became operational. You know, I think we have a lot that should be concentrated on, and less concern and worry about, oh, let's shore up the prevailing paradigm. If the prevailing paradigm is right, it can be defended with incoming data, right? If it's mistaken,
it can stand on its own two feet. Yes.
It can stand on its own two feet, you know. If not, well, hey, maybe it needs to be tweaked or majorly changed in some way, you know.
That's right. Yes. It's so, and you know, speaking statistically again,
yes,
just because, and here I'm going to share a screen again myself.
Sure, yeah.
So we look at, where is this link that I wanted to take a look at? We've seen stuff like this to sort of repeat what we've seen.
Yes.
It's these monster galaxies. And yep. I'm not going to go into the whole thing again, but this is what I mean about statistical. So Ethan Siegel, he makes a statistical case for why we should treat those large structures as artifacts.
Okay.
But the interesting thing to me is when we see a monster galaxy, you know, a few hundred million years before the Big Bang, we see this monster galaxy, and I'm going to stop sharing now.
Since the Big Bang, you mean?
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. So we see this monster galaxy, and so instead of saying, okay, like the basic Big Bang is disproven, instead all the articles, they phrase it in the sense of, scientists are going to have to rethink how galaxies form in order that they could form so quickly. And so the underlying assumption there constantly is that we can't question the Big Bang, right?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, you know, we can't question that. The only question here is how could they have formed? And I am like very out of focus. What's going on with my camera? Sorry about that, everybody.
No, no. Yeah, oh, yeah. I see what you're saying.
I just would like to say that the lack of focus of the camera is not demonstrative of my focus on what I'm trying to say here. So. Right. Anyways, so my point is, with Ethan, he seems to have wants to go with what is statistically probable, in his view, in one case. But in this case, I mean, it strains credulity, and it strains probability to think that a very much typical galaxy like we'd see now with the same metallicities and everything else, you know, is there it is, like, you know, 400 yep. billion years after the Big Bang. And you want to talk about statistically how the heck that thing can form. I mean, for a galaxy that size to make one rotation takes 300 million years.
Right.
Yep. Just to rotate one time.
Right. Right.
And so there it is, like fully formed with the spiral arms and everything, like 400 million years after the Big Bang. It's, well, anyway, so I have a problem.
It's true that, yeah, I've posted in another chapter on the website, I've posted some more stuff. A recent paper that have come out dealing with galaxies that have seem to have quite mature stellar populations, might quite mature morphology, and less than a billion years after the Big Bang.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's just, it's like, if we say that's improbable, you know, that does not seem to get us anywhere.
Right. Well, see, I mean, it would be one thing if this was the, and if I might share just briefly, then I'll, you know, here, if, you know, and of course, they actually, with this ring and so forth, with this large structure, the authors toy in their conversations, well, maybe another cosmology is necessary, and they referenced the conformal cyclic cosmology of Sir Roger Penrose, you know, as a, and his colleagues as a possible, you know, because his cosmology has been predicting that there's going to be large ring-like structures on the CMB, you know, concentric areas of decreased variability and all of that. And there have been some structures observed, and he and his group herald them as evidence of artifacts from a previous cycle of the universe in their cosmology. I have not yet published the chapter where I review his and some other comparable cosmologies.
And I'm curious, with their cyclic, because I haven't seen that work, in their cyclic cosmology, are they saying that the something like the Hubble constant goes positive and negative, like there's a movement back and forth?
Or no.
How do they, like when they say cyclic cosmology, what do they mean?
Yes, what they mean is that if you, because it's conformal, they basically say, you know, and he discussed it in his Nobel address too, when he won the Nobel Prize for his black hole theorem, you know, back in the, which he published back in the 60s, in 2020, he discussed this, and in recent years he has published some popular works and some papers, he and his colleagues, on this subject, with colleagues in, as far as the papers, he with popular books, and essentially what it is that as our universe becomes more and more spread out and black holes eventually evaporate through Hawking radiation and all of that, that essentially you can do a conformal rescaling because a photon, you know, being massless is also timeless, right? So, you know, so therefore you can do a rescaling and start over with another big bang. So you have successive bangs after each other, after which they become, there's this conformal rescaling and everything. I have a chapter coming up which discusses all of that, which illustrates with the papers and the graphics and all of that. Uh-huh. But that's essentially, and one of the predictions is that you're going to see evidences on the CMB at the surface of last scattering in standard cosmology from about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. You're going to see artifacts of the Hawking points of the final disappearance of supermassive black holes from the previous eon, leaving this sort of pattern, this concentric, this ring-like pattern of reduced or dampened variability in the CMB temperature. And they are arguing that is a prediction of their cosmology. And they argue, of course, there's others that vociferously disagree, that some of those have already been found. So that's...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to take a look at that because I'm not really understanding.
Yes, it's...
I'll have to take a look at it.
Yes, well... It's a beautiful concept mathematically, but it's a mathematical concept, the conformal rescaling thing. And of course, his skeptics will say, but there's no evidence that anything like that can happen in physics. And he says, you know, so anyway, they have that.
Well, I mean, yeah, but they do inflation without evidence.
Well, I understand.
So it's like, yeah, some of this, standard cosmologists, they can't really...
No, I know.
They can't argue against purely mathematical models because
that's
what inflation is.
Right. Well, so anyway, just to go down to some of the other stuff that emerges from this, some of these structures, of course, like the gamma ray burster structures, there's a anisotropic distribution of gamma ray bursters on the sky. So that's a violation of isotropy there, for instance.
Yeah, and isotropy, again, to remind the viewers, isotropy means that no matter what direction you look, things should look pretty much the same. Whatever direction you look. Yes.
That's right. And this was a paper, you know, this is a paper before the JWST. This is Horvath et al. Of 2014. And they're looking at, you know, and we're looking at some pretty deep, 1.6 to 2.1 Z values, or high, very high red shifts. And these aggregations would suggest that there's huge structures out there, 6.5 to 9.8 gigalight years, billion light years, which is well, quite far beyond the lambda cold dark matter size limit,
Right.
and so that's just some of that. Here's another one here. This was a paper. This is Balazs et al. 2015. Another large, 5.61 gigalight years. This huge, this ring-like structure of gamma ray bursters, and it's way out there, one, 1720 megaparsecs, so this is a huge, 5.6 gigalight years. That's a big structure,
Right. And
and
someone.
it's a 2 × 10⁻⁶ probability of just being a random fluctuation.
Yeah, I was going to say, someone's going to say it's an artifact.
Yes, right. And if and we've looked at this paper before. Some of these pencil surveys going out there seem to show sort of a wave structure of, higher density, lower density
Okay,
that.
and for my audience, I just want to explain, when we say a pencil survey,
Yes, pencil survey.
we're
Yes,
talking about a narrow beam
yes.
that we're shooting out into the universe, and we are looking at how densely there are galaxies in that beam as we look about it. And we're
Yes.
seeing, like, areas where galaxies are dense, areas where galaxies are sparse, areas
Yes.
where they're dense, and we're finding that it varies kind of like a wave.
Yep.
And so I would just like to point out that
Yes.
cyclic
Exactly.
gravity and cosmology, CGC, kind of predicts this sort of wave-like structure in the form of sort of rings, for all mass. I mean, so what I mean by that is, I shouldn't say mass, all scales. So if you're talking about galaxies, if you're talking about solar systems, you're talking about galaxy clusters, you're talking about the universe as a whole, you may see this sort of ring type structure in CGC. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yes, that's right. And of course, some of these periodicities, some of these structures, if these are not real, I mean, if these are real density differences, that these would be structures, on the order of nearly 10 gigalight years across. That's a massive structure,
Yeah, now that, I don't see how someone could look at that and say that could be an artifact. I mean, I don't know, understand, because I mean, we're if we do a pencil survey, we're going to see what mass is in that pencil.
Right. Now, of course, one has to recognize, and we haven't gotten into the issue, and we will at some time in the future, of redshift anomalies. But this is saying, let's just say that the Hubble constant holds all the way across. These look like bona fide structures out there, big structures,
Right.
So, a paper that I just and then there's the whole issue about voids and all that stuff and how that affects the microwave background radiation. Whole other topic there, of course. As far as the issues of violations, possible violations of isotropy, a review was recently published, which basically, well, basically, this review asks the big question, Are the homogeneity and the isotropy assumptions behind the standard cosmology of lambda cold dark matter even met? You know, is the cosmological principle that's been so foundational sound? And so they go and review a lot of the data there. They of course view some of the big structures that we've discussed here that Siegel talks about in his op-ed and so forth, and some of the issues that we just mentioned about anisotropies, you know, like in gamma ray bursters and structures there. And it's very interesting that in 1989, when the first Great Wall was discovered in a survey back then with Geller and so forth, Vera Rubin, you know, the great astronomer, said this: "It certainly has convinced me." That was the 89 discovery of the Great Wall. "It certainly has convinced me that we're not living in a homogeneous isotropic universe. I mean, these things that I really suspected in the back of my mind, I can now say publicly, I'm not sure the Robertson-Walker universe exists." That's very interesting. And that's way back then, you know, that she said that.
And so what would she say now?
Well, so here's a little summary. As far as issues of anisotropy in the universe, what we have here, you know, in galaxy clusters, dipoles in the various cosmological parameters, of course, the kinematic dipole, you know, within the cosmic microwave radiation and so forth, the CMB, bulk flows nearby and all of that. Notice that these...
Excuse me. I just want to, for our viewers, just sort of, when we're talking about pole, dipole, quadrupole, all of that kind of thing, think of a pole in this context as a direction. Okay, and so if you have a dipole, that means you have two different directions.
Yes.
And so if things look different in those two directions, then you've got a dipole problem.
Yes.
So that's what all this talk about poles is. All this is a list of things, a list of different things that we can look at.
Yes.
Where we can look in this direction and see what they're like, and then we can look in another direction and see what they're like.
Correct.
So each of these things we can look at and compare the poles. Does it look
That's
the same
correct.
Or not? Does it
That's
look the
correct.
Same or not? And so I just wanted to say that for the audience here.
And the more incongruences you have between these different groups of poles, the more you begin to wonder, well, are the simple assumptions of the Friedman, Loeb, Maitre, Walker, Robertson-Walker model even met? Maybe we're barking up the wrong tree, you know.
Yeah, now, so basically,
yeah. Go ahead.
The assumptions are not met.
Correct. Yes, the assumptions, they try value, you know, it's a big paper. And it's well worth, you know, the readers, anybody who is interested should go through it. I've got it linked on my website in this chapter, you know, and all of that. But hey, it's 102 pages. There's a lot of interesting information there, and they're struggling to make it work within a standard cosmology of, you know, the Friedman Lemaître cosmology.
Okay, well, I would just like to close with a couple of things, sort of going off in a totally different direction. Just some things I noticed in the news. Oh, and I better share a screen myself here. So let me do that. I was about to start sharing when I wasn't sharing. And so the thing I want to take a look at, because it just reminded me of something.
Yes.
And that is this paper I saw recently about the asteroid Dimorphos, where NASA hit it with a missile called the DART impact.
Yes.
And from observations and modeling, this group of researchers, and again, I'll put this link in the comments later, This group of researchers thinks that it may be a large rubble pile where the impact might have caused a lot more deformation, and there might not be a distinct like impact crater. And so I bring this up only because viewers of the Taurus Report are aware of my hypothesis I put forward, CGC, cyclic gravity and cosmology, wherein all masses, according to what I'm saying, must exist in certain discrete sizes. Because I believe that gravity is cyclic in the sense that as you get away from the center of the object, whatever it is, gravity will vary in a wave-like way as you get away from it. And so objects need to be of certain discrete sizes, because otherwise, when they get near the surface of that object, there might be repulsive gravity. And so any object that we encounter in the universe that is maybe still in the process of formation might behave like, as it's described in this article, like a loose pile of rubble. Now, we actually saw with Bennu, when the OSIRIS mission went there, we actually saw pebbles inexplicably being expelled out into space from the surface of that asteroid. And when they tried to land on it, the lander just like sunk right into it, like it was a, as they described it, like a ball pit, you know, that the kids play in at, you know, like Chuck E. Cheese or something. And so it was very unexpected. And I think that, well, in my opinion, that we will encounter objects like this in the universe that are of the proper size, where their surface isn't stable, and maybe only very lightly held together. Now, in that context, I wanted to propose an experiment to do here on Earth to test this idea. I propose taking some weights on a very fine scale, I mean, as fine as is feasible, and starting with those weights at the bottom of like the Marianas Trench, a deep trench in the ocean, and slowly coming up and weighing continuously the same object. Like, let's suppose, you know, we have some 10 gram object, or I don't know what would be the ideal weight where the scale would be most accurate. Manufacturers of the scale would know, I would assume. And so then gradually just bring it up to the surface, and then from the surface continue with like a weather balloon or something, bring it up as high as that will go. And then after that, do a statistical study of the velocities of satellites.
Yes.
Progressively more distant orbits. Because for an object that's not under propulsion and it is in orbit, all you need is the velocity of the object to know the strength of gravity. You don't actually even need to know the weight of the object. If it's in a stable orbit, all you need to know is the velocity. And so if they take the velocities of these satellites and go out and out and out and out, I think putting all of this data together, that the gravitational force will vary from a smooth curve in a wave-like way, that there will be slight variations, unexpected slight variations in a wave-like way. And so that is my prediction. And I'm actually hoping to write some kind of grant proposal to have this done. And hopefully we could work together on that, Leo.
Yeah, Oh yeah, that sounds interesting. That sounds interesting. Yeah, I would like to be a part of that, Joe. And also that reminds me of some of the discussions that we've had before, which weren't broadcast, where we've said, well, where you've su suggested to me that maybe some of the structural phenomena that we see out there in the universe may be reflective of some of more complex properties of a modified gravity, as it were.
Right. That's right. Yes. And so, yes. Yeah, so, have you, anything else that you'd like to discuss tonight, Lee?
Well, there's
Have we covered,
we have covered a lot
questions?
of ground. We've given people things to think about and to look up and all of that. And certainly there's more data. I'm trying to keep up myself. The data keeps coming out, and papers also from former, earlier papers, some as I come across them. Oh yeah, this really belongs here in the story. I'm trying to insert them in,
Yes, and as I've said, I am going to include a link to your site so that our viewers can go and really look in depth at the real wealth of documentation of all this that is there. And I want to thank you for that.
Oh, well, and thank you for also, Joe. I really appreciate our chances to talk together on these things. Maybe we'll do a program sometime in person since we don't live that far apart from each other,
Hey, that sounds good.
right?
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you again soon. Goodbye for now.
Take care.
Bye-bye.